City. It is John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you, hanging out, doing a little talking about what's going on Pop Dose and elsewhere. And Rob, how's your week been so far?
So far, so good, John. How are you doing?
Not bad. Not bad at all. Picked up a new amplifier. Pretty happy about that. And now I'm making the neighbors angry.
You know, I wish that I could be in that position again. I haven't cranked up my amp since I don't remember when. Probably the last time that maybe the Punchline played live, because it's still in its road case after all these years.
Yeah, see, time to crank that thing back up and make sure that people start beating on your walls and on the ceiling and everything else.
Yeah, well, they would probably do it in the middle of the night when I'm asleep.
True enough, and we've got a whole bunch to talk about this week, and unfortunately, we're going to start out with some of the bad news, or maybe not, that's gone on over the last little while, and there was, in our sort of sad goodbyes and fond farewells segment of the program that we had spent so much time doing because we kept losing cool people, we missed one just a couple of weeks ago, and I know this is something that, for an English beat fan as you are, Sax's death is something that means a lot. Talk a little bit about the history of this for folks who don't know.
Well, Saxa, whose real name was Lionel Martin, was just the most incredible and soulful sax player who had been with the English Beat since their formation in Birmingham in 1979. And, you know, at the time, he was already in his 50s, having played with everybody from Prince Buster to the Beatles. And, you know, he joined this band of young ruffians who wanted to make this joyful ska noise, and he was that last little bit of flavor that they needed to push them right into that realm of perfection that they did indeed master. The English Beat, I prefer calling them the English Beat because it just sounds cooler, yeah. Actually. I thought out of all the ska revival bands, they were the band. I thought they were far and away broader and much more appealing on so many levels than the Specials, than Madness, than the Selector. You know, ska, as much as I love it, has a short shelf life. You can only listen to just so much.
Right.
As much of an upbeat and joyful feeling it gives you, it's limiting. But the Beat didn't stop with just being a ska band. You know, as was evidenced in the transition between I Just Can't Stop It, their first album, and Whoppin', their second album, which, if you go back and listen to it, and it has a lot more of straight reggae and calypso and pop feel, Sax's playing was so much more prevalent on that record than the first. And I think it just solidified how much of a cohesive unit they really were.
Yeah.
One member wasn't more important than the other, but certainly the sound of his saxophone was one of their absolute trademarks.
Yeah, and it's funny because you mentioned a couple of bands in there. With Madness, they always had that sort of loose vibe about them. And with the Specials, it was always the exact opposite of that. Everything was very precise. And the English Beat kind of hit that sweet spot in the middle where they seemed to have a really deep understanding of the music. And along with that came a very relaxed kind of feel about it, but an importance to it as well, I think.
Well, I agree with you, especially with the fact that the Specials, for all intents and purposes, were directed by Jerry Dammers. It was the Jerry Dammers show. I mean, if you listen to the first Specials album and then you listen to more Specials, he dictated a complete sound change. The only track on more Specials that sounds like the band is Rat Race, which was recorded during the first album sessions and held off as a single. It was more like Muzak, to be honest with you,
right,
when you listen to the second album. Madness were always just kind of, you know, goofy and funny, and live I was really, really sorely disappointed by them more than once. But with the Beat, they had so many different influences going into the mixture. You know, you had their love of reggae, their love of pure pop and power pop. I mean, if you ask, I think Dave Wakeling, Andy Cox, and Andy Steele, what one of their, you know, each one of their favorite singles were, I think they'd all say Shake Some Action by the Flaming Groovies. You know, those guys really had a love of pop music. You know, you throw in the drumming style of Everett Morton, who was a, you know, a top flight reggae drummer, but he knew how to rock. I mean, listen to Two Swords or Best Friend or Click Click. I mean, that's thunder drumming right there, just pure out-and-out punk pop. You know, and of course, Ranking Roger, who was a master toaster, was a first wave punk rock teen. You know, he was a drummer himself in a band called the Dum Dum Boys. So you throw Saxa into the mix, and you really had just this Wonderful musical salad.
Right, right. It was a very cool thing. So again, sad news on his death at age 87. And the other one that shook the rock world over the last couple of days was a suicide that took place. Chris Cornell, with the work that he did, I'm a longtime grunge hater. I just don't like it. I didn't like it when it happened. And it wasn't, I mean, I was in the age group that was supposed to just dearly love it, and I didn't. But he's one of those guys whose voice is undeniable.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that I actually liked Soundgarden and never equated them with grunge, simply because they were about 4 years ahead of grunge.
Yeah, true.
You know, their first records were on SST and Sub Pop, but that was before grunge was even a thing. Yeah, and he was just such a great rock singer, and he had a great presence. But he also had a way with lyrics. And I will grant you, I can't stand anything aligned with Rage Against the Machine / Audioslave, because I hate their whole political bullshit thing.
Right.
But having Chris Cornell as their singer certainly gave them a quality that they certainly lacked in their prior incarnation. Nevertheless, Chris Cornell's death by suicide was absolutely, first of all, it was very sad to wake up to, because that was an early morning story.
Yep.
And second of all, it was just shocking to think that he would take his own life. You know, there are the stories that he had had drug and alcohol problems, but he'd apparently been clean for several years. So what would drive someone to take his own life while on tour, I don't know. I'm not going to speculate, but it is very sad. And most importantly, it's devastating for his family, you know, his wife, his children, his friends and bandmates. It's a very, very sad state of affairs. And,
you know,
God rest his soul.
Indeed. And that does give us something else to go off into before we get to the last death, which is one of the more controversial of the week. But that idea, and I'm glad you didn't do that, of people who have decided to jump into this and say whatever they want to about Chris Cornell's death. The one thing that we all have in common is that none of us was there, and none of us was inside that guy's head. And the fact is that it's easy afterward to say, oh, you know, he took the coward's way out or whatever it was. I don't know a thing about what was going on in Chris Cornell's life or about what led up to his suicide. So the last thing I'm going to do is make myself look stupid by trying to come up with some kind of a, you know, a bullshit opinion about it.
Well, that's the very fucked up thing about when a famous person takes their own life. It's one thing if it's a celebrity death because of illness or an accident or old age. When it's something like this, everyone loves to pontificate and
yep.
put their two cents in. And they do it in such a callous manner that, you know, for fans of the band or performer or actor or actress or whomever it was, you know, that's just – it's unnecessarily cruel. Because there's an emotional investment made in these people, which is what makes them celebrities. And to sit there and state your so-called expertise, your knowledge, your wisdom is horseshit.
Yep.
And I don't have the time, the patience, the wherewithal, and I certainly am not going to import any respect towards that kind of an opinion. You want to say you're sad? I understand it. You want to say you're confused and you don't understand why? I completely respect where you're coming from with it, but don't you dare sit there and put your two cents in, like you said. Just if you can't say anything decent, sound, or compassionate, keep your fucking mouth shut.
Indeed. And really, that goes right to the heart of my industry in talk radio, because I think when it lost its soul is when we who sit behind these microphones decided that we couldn't anymore ever admit when we just didn't know what the fuck we were talking about. You know what I mean? There's a lot of stuff I don't know, and I've never been afraid to say, look, I just have no frame of reference here. I can't talk about that, so I'm not going to come up with an opinion about it. There is no crime in that whatsoever. And yet the guys who do this, for the most part, for a living, sit there and tell you that they're an expert on absolutely everything, and don't you dare question them. And it's just, it's horse shit, and I hate it.
And that's why the news media has become what it's become, because they're
yep.
the biggest purveyors of that kind of nonsense.
Right.
And it's gotten to the point where it's so not just out of control, but it's downright dangerous especially in the time and circumstances that we're living under right this moment.
Yeah, which brings us exactly very nicely right up to the third death of this week, Roger Ailes, the man who was responsible in large degree, both in radio, and I don't know how many people know that, and in television, for driving that exact point of view, that you have to be the expert and that nobody can ever question what you say. And what he did with Fox News was deplorable. And to see that in the days leading up to his death, that he had the downfall that he did because of the sexual harassment allegations and everything else that was going on apparently behind the scenes at Fox News, with not only him, but Bill O'Reilly and the rest of them, it just underscores exactly what an asshole that guy was.
Yeah, and you know what? This is one of those moments where I will take a liberty. And I will, I will dance a jig of joy at his death, because Roger Ailes was a scumbag.
Yep.
He was just an absolutely abhorrent human being whose philosophy was, it doesn't matter if it's true or not. It's news, and we're going to push it.
Right.
And we're going to push it using our agenda and our opinions, and we're going to make you buy it and believe it. And if you don't believe it, then you're the enemy, and then we're going to attack you, and we're going to try and belittle you and take your name down into the mud. So fuck him. Let him rock. And hit his head, and that was the main cause of his death.
Right.
Very, very just. There are moments that once again reaffirm my complete and utter belief in karmic justice, and that was karmic justice, that he lingered for about a week and then he died. Too fucking bad.
Right, and the one rule that I've always had is you can do anything you want. You can disagree with me. You can tell me I'm full of shit for my opinions. That's fine, and that's fair, and you can say anything you want in response, and we can have those conversations, but don't insult my intelligence. We report, you decide. Oh, bullshit. I mean, just stop it.
We report, and you've decided.
Yeah, right. We've decided for you. Yep. Oh, just terrible.
We will make your decision. So you know what? Again, let him rot. Let this be the first domino, although I find it very interesting. Roger Ailes is the one who was the first to, quote, get fired, and he's the first one to die. I wonder how many more deaths will be happening in the aftermath of all these little dominoes falling one by one.
So is Bill O'Reilly's next book Killing Roger Ailes?
Who knows? Would he not venture down that road? I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, I bet he would.
Nothing. I mean, he's a charlatan.
Right. And the thing is, yeah, Bill O'Reilly came out earlier this week and said that it was hatred. It was all of the hatred that killed Roger Ailes. Well, you know what? If that were true, O'Reilly would have been gone a long time ago.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that whole network would be off the air because they'd all be dead by now. It never ceases to amaze me the absolute audacity of that man.
If only it were that easy.
The lack of restraint. But you know what? Every dog has its day.
Yeah.
And Bill O'Reilly's has yet to come.
Right. Indeed. And again, you're listening to Radio City. John Grayson and Rob Ross hanging out doing some talking. It's time to get into some of the fun stuff because we've got a lot of new music to talk about. And one of the ones that we're going to kick off with here is a young lady by the name of Ellie Perry. And before you introduced us to her music, I had not heard of her before. Where did she come from?
She's a Georgia native. And, you know, she's been out there, you know, singing for quite a while and touring a lot. She's kind of a road warrior at this point. And she actually started to feel the interesting thing is about this new album that we have called Little Thieves is that it was based around her exhaustion after touring and performing for over a year. You know, she was burned out. She became something of a recluse and she was dealing with some personal issues. And once she cleared her cobwebs, she started to compose the album, and it's quite a little record of that period.
It sounds terrific. And the one thing, I'm very picky, much more so probably than I should be when it comes to female vocalists. And I can't really quantify it except to tell you that I know that it's there. And I'm just really picky when it comes to this. And there are two things that I'm not fond of. One is I'm so sexy I can barely whisper. And the other one is, I'm going to blow you out of the room with my voice. And she doesn't do either one. She's very, I won't say subdued, because I don't think that's the right word to use, but she understands where her voice hits best. And that's an important thing for me when I'm listening to somebody like her sing.
You're right. Her voice is absolutely balanced. You know, it's tempered for the song.
Yep.
You know, when she needs to rev it up a bit, she does for the song.
Yep.
When it's time to draw it back a bit, she does it for the song. You know, case in point, Smoking Gun, which is kind of a poppy song, if you will, it's got that kind of passionate vocal, and yet you can imagine it coming out of the radio. Because it has that kind of restraint.
Right.
It doesn't go completely balls out to the point of, okay, this is just a shout.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Love is a Ship is just a very quiet, well, it feels like a very personal piece because it, you know, it definitely exudes heartbreak and loss. You know, it's got that mournful vibe, but it's also very warm and countrified.
Yeah.
You know, so again, she knows how to veer between the up and up tempo to the, you know, withheld and calm slash quieter style of a ballad.
Right. Yeah. There's an intelligence to it.
And plus there's just a lot of raw gut emotion in this. You feel this record. You can feel it. You understand, especially once you know the backstory, you feel it even more.
Yeah.
And that's what I liked about this record so much.
It's very cool. Ellie Perry's brand new one. And what the name of the album again is?
Little Thieves.
Little Thieves. So definitely want to add this one to the collection. And another guy that we've talked about a lot over time, because he's given us a lot of great music to talk over, is Wade Jackson. And he's got a brand new one as well. It's called Crown and Cathedral. Where does he go with a new record?
He's gone into a realm which I would not have expected. Or maybe I should have. Possibly. And I say that because if you listen to his previous albums, they are progressions. But, you know, the whole thing is Whiskey Alpha Delta Echo, the previous album, was such a pop, power pop album of the highest order. And it melds all of what you and me and everyone we know loves about that genre.
Mm-hmm.
He's taken it out of the 60s, and now he's moved it into the 70s. And not unlike where the Blood Rush Hour went on Who Folds First, Crown and Cathedral goes into another decade completely. And he's taken this new record, Crown and Cathedral, like we've said, into not just the 70s for the more rockin' and groovin' songs, which he does do here, but he suddenly leapfrogs into, I guess, what you'd call the late 90s with the start of the whole dance and soundscape kind of vibe.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting, you know, two ends of the spectrum. He basically has overlooked the 80s, which I think is a really cool thing, but he's got the 70s, he's got this kind of, dare I say, like an almost prog rock synth groove going on in a track called Before It Gets Too Cold, which at the same time, when you listen to it structurally and vocally, sounds like Van Doren.
Nice.
Believe is the perfect Van Doren Todd Rundgren hybrid.
Yeah, and there's a song that you've got linked on the page which has a terrific video to it that's set in an amusement park called Someone Else's Dream. And that song struck me because, like you said, it's got a lot of that DNA from the early 70s to it. And there was a sound back then that you heard a lot, and I don't want to make this comparison. This is not a comparison in terms of the style of the music because it's not Cheap Tricky at all. But those Gibson Explorers, there's a clangy sound to them that comes through a little bit in some of the background, you know, the background guitar work, the rhythm guitar work on that song, that I think it's difficult to do that well. And the way that song is produced, it's done really well.
Well, that's the thing. I think Wade Jackson is not only an incredible musician, not forgetting that he plays all the parts himself, but he's also quite the scholar. So his knowledge, his deep, deep love and appreciation for these different styles of music is what enables him to make the kind of albums that he has made. Certainly the two albums that you and I have listened to and dissected and devoured are just, you know, they're again, those rare gems that once you find them, you don't want to let go, but you want the next album to be just as good, if not better.
Yeah, and it's so, certainly a progression here.
Yeah, I mean, he's done it again in a different vein, but he's done it again.
It's called Crown and Cathedral, and again, it's out from Wade Jackson. The review is up on the page at popdose.com from Rob Ross. And we go to one of your colleagues for the next album review because Big Thief is back with more music. Who was it that took us through the new video that's on Popdose?
Well, it was Alison Boron, who, you know, I have to admit, I've always enjoyed what she writes and the way she goes about doing it because it the way she delivers the setup immediately intrigues you into wanting to hear and find out about who she's reviewing. And this band called Big Thief have put out this new video for their forthcoming album, which is called Capacity. That'll be out June 9th. This video for a song called Mythological Beauty, which is a true story in a song and, you know, semi-autobiographical video. And all I can say is that the story, when you watch it visually, is striking. It's set in the snow. It is set in what looks like to be very difficult circumstances. But vocally and lyrically, while there's a story of pain and suffering, there is a spark of hope. And you can also hear it in the lead singer, and her name is Adrienne Lenker.
You cut the flesh of your left thumb using your boyfriend's knife. 17, you took his cum and he gave birth to your first life. You gave it to a family who you thought would love and take better care.
You can hear it in her voice, so it's almost a happier, much more pleasing vocal akin to, ooh, this pains me to say because I so despise this woman, Sinead O'Connor.
I heard because some of that too. Yeah,
that kind of gentility, but there's none of that ichness about it. You know, this woman has a very warming and embracing voice.
Yeah.
And makes you sit and listen through the whole thing. You basically want to get to the end of the story for there to be a happy ending.
Right. And what's missing is the Sinead O'Connor self-importance that isn't there in this song. And it's funny because, you know, it's been posited before that good times are lousy for music. And I think that's true on a grand scheme, and it's also true on a personal level, that the last thing that a musician wants to be is satisfied. And tough times make for great stories, and this is certainly one of them. It's called Mythological Beauty. It's out from Big Thief, and the review and the video is up on the page from Alison Boron at popdose.com. We've got a few more things to talk about, and you're listening to Radio City for this week. And we also have a brand new, I don't know about brand new, but we have news about one of your favorites. I know Paul Weller has meant a lot to you as a singer and a songwriter. So what's new in his world?
Two albums, actually. And another baby on the way.
Speaking of tough times, yeah, right.
Seventh grade kid. You know, who would have thought? Good on you, Paul. Two albums. First and foremost is his first ever soundtrack album. You know, in such a lengthy and storied career, and by the way, it is exactly 40 years ago this week, In the City was released, the album In the City was released by The Jam. 40 fucking years ago. Now it really makes me feel my age.
Yeah.
But in this long, storied, incredible career of Paul Weller, which has had so many lives to it, he's only just done his first soundtrack album, which I think is a phenomenal thing.
Yeah.
It's the score for a movie called Jawbone. The album is, you know, properly titled Music from the Film Jawbone. It's certainly a labor of love. It's about a boxer, and Weller's father, his late father John, was in fact an amateur boxer, so I can understand why he would be attracted to this project. The movie stars, you know, certainly one of my favorite English actors, Ray Winstone, mm-hmm. whose first film role was in Quadrophenia. And it's basically about a former boxing champion who is trying once again to gain glory. Now, there's only 7 tracks on this, and it definitely is not something I would expect from Paul Weller, and that is a good thing, because you don't know what you're going to get with a soundtrack. You know, the thing is, he makes it a soundtrack. You know, he makes it a score. The first piece, which is called Jimmy/Blackout, is 21 minutes and 30 seconds.
Wow.
And it's a mixture of soundscapes and ambience. There's kind of these twisting moods and, you know, sound effects like a radio dial being twisted around and a melodically controlled guitar feedback squeal. Then it disappears into this auralness and you keep having these, you know, sounds weaving in and out. Then about 17 minutes in, it's almost like a chorale starts to sing and you can hear Weller's voice kind of in a foggy echo in the distance.
Nice.
It's very reminiscent to Scott Walker. Okay, and certainly the things that Scott Walker has done ever since he gave up doing Jacques Brel covers.
Okay.
You know, basically everything Scott Walker has done since the Climate of Hunter album. So, you know, to make that comparison, it's hard to do this because, you know, Weller is my hero, but Scott Walker to me is the greatest singer that ever lived who turned his back on singing.
Yeah.
But, okay. You know, I don't want to digress. And now at the same time, there are 2 acoustic tracks on this album that are, I think, and we're talking now after 40 years, 2 of Weller's finest moments. The Ballad of Jimmy McCabe is just very soft, very sweet. It's just Weller, his voice, and an acoustic guitar, and it really makes you want to cry.
When you're gonna find the strength to be, clear your mind of the darkness that you see. I'll run till my legs expire. Lay me down in the cold winds quiet. Only there will I find purity. Look for that homecoming, sweet daddy, oh. Look for that star shining, sweet Kitty, oh, I'm coming home.
It's emotionally impactful, it's powerful, it's simple, and it is one of the most beautiful things he has ever written, performed, and committed to tape. You know, you can take a song like Monday, you can take a song like English Rose, a song like Fly, a song like Spring, Summer, Autumn, and put them all up against this one. That's how powerful this is. Bottle is another one, and it's another tearjerker. And it again, it's just his guitar, his acoustic guitar, and his voice. And he seems to hit these new emotional high points. So that's what you get from the Jawbone soundtrack. It's worth it, especially if you're a fan of Weller's and you're a completist.
Okay.
If you're the casual observer, I'm sure these songs will be singled out for compilation in the not-too-distant future. So moving on from the Jawbone soundtrack, we have the new album, the new official album, A Kind Revolution, which came out on Friday the 12th. Now, it's not enough that he just released the soundtrack, and that was in February. But now, A Kind Revolution is, you would have thought after the direction shifts that he did with Sonic Kicks and then Saturn's Pattern, that he'd probably revert back into a more safe kind of feel.
Yeah.
No. I mean, this is the great thing about Weller's career since easily 2010. I consider that the pinpoint of when he became completely recharged, when he released the Wake Up the Nation album. Because just to give a quick background, there are a couple of things that I think went into making that such a lively record. You know, John Weller died after suffering from Alzheimer's in 2009. At the same time, Weller was reconnected and reunited, both as a musician and more importantly as a friend, with Bruce Foxton, his bass-playing comrade from The Jam.
Okay.
And they both suffered together because Bruce Foxton's wife, Pat, was suffering and ultimately died from cancer. So, you know, these two men went through the same horrible experiences of watching a loved one evaporate before their eyes. And, you know, the fences were mended. Bruce Foxton is actually on Wake Up the Nation with Weller, appeared with him live to perform things like the Eaton Rifles and Down in the Tube Station, which, you know, I don't think anybody ever expected to ever see again. And that, I think, started Weller's sense of almost joyful abandon, because this black cloud was no longer hanging overhead for all intents and purposes. So Sonic Kicks comes along, and that is just such a happy and light and buoyant and completely not what you'd expect from Weller kind of record, using the electronics and that kind of Kraftwerk feel to some of the songs. And, you know, and then Saturn's Pattern was just this down and out hard rock, heavy duty, almost metal at points, you know, a little bit of the Stooges kind of vibe. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, where did he go with this? And now it's more of the same, not the same, but the more of the same, I'm going forward. And, you know, he gets this thing going. And case in point, long, long road. Now, the thing about Weller is he's a master, no matter what genre he's going to approach, master of the ballad. The guy writes ballads that make you want to tear your heart out, that make you want to just get a bucket for the tears that are going to fall.
Yeah.
And Long, Long Road is a complete stunner. You know, it's a pure – when I say this is a soul track, this is a soul in capital letters track. You've got a piano. You've got very tasteful guitars. You've got the Hammond B3. You've got strings. And again, an incredible vocal performance from him. Actually, he's going to be 59 in a couple of days. Strike that, because next year is his 60th birthday. And it seems like his voice is just getting better.
Yeah.
It's richer and much more powerful.
Not only that, but I mean, to see somebody who is at that stage, not only of their career, but that stage of life heading into 60 years old, still pushing out at the boundaries, still creating and still going off in different directions. Boy.
That's part of his philosophy. I mean, if you ask him or if you read it in interviews, he's the one thing that he does say pretty much on a regular basis is, I'll stop doing this when I'm either dead or there's no place else for me to go.
Yeah. I can't think of anything new to do.
I hate to say it, but and maybe I'm glad to say it, actually, as much as it pains me, is that with all the things that he eschewed musically for so many years that he was against, you know, and I'm sure you remember the days when he used to mock Bowie and Bolan and all that kind of stuff, when he was playing that first wave of punk, deny everything that went before, except, you know, in his case, the Who, the Small Faces, and the Beatles. Well, he's atoning for all of that now.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, I would never in a million years equate Paul Weller with having listened to the Stooges. You know what I mean?
Right.
And, you know, so as I was saying about this track, The Long, Long Road, I think this is about the most spiritual, I mean, really spiritual I've ever heard him with a piece that is as close to Let It Be as you can get, with that kind of immediate emotional hook that just goes right into you and pulls you in. But then you get a track like New York, which has a very New York feel and vibe about it. You know, it's got some Latin flavors. It's atmospheric. It's got a really strident and funky bass line. Woo Say Mama is just this great kind of get down, early, late 60s, early 70s. I would say maybe taking its musical cue from Steve Winwood a la Traffic around the, you know, that changeover period, maybe a little later in the 70s, around the period of Low Spark of High Heeled Boys.
Yeah.
But the one song that's a real shocker on this one for me is a track called Nova. When I tell you, I kid you not, it's so 1980, 81, new wave with like the synth bleeps and parps. I swear to you, John, my first thought was it's the Cars. That's who it reminded me of.
You talked me into it. To hear Paul Weller doing a Cars song, I am there. I am absolutely so there.
He's, I mean, the guy is just, it's like he's sitting at the musical smorgasbord and just having a grand old time with it.
Good.
And good for him.
Yeah.
You know, that's what keeps it interesting. That's what keeps it fresh, because it was getting samey. And I have to tell you, I think the nadir of his solo career thus far was one of his most successful albums, the Double 22 Dreams album, which I listened to once and just could not stand.
Yeah.
It was so boring and lifeless to me. So from Wake Up the Nation onward, he redeemed himself and redeemed his career. And, you know, it's a great thing to see him, like you said, you know, almost 60, still pushing forward. And that's what makes it all the more worth its while.
A Kind Revolution is the new record, and it's out from Paul Weller. And I want to stick with the Cars for just a second, because something occurred to me earlier this week, and I know I'm not the first one to say it, but I'm going to say it again and just kind of throw it at you and ask you why it is that Elliot Easton's name never comes up when the discussion of great guitarists happens.
That's a good question. It's an obnoxious thing that he's so often overlooked, because
talented son of a bitch. Wow.
One of the most tasteful and economic guitarists I've ever heard. He's one of the guys that really embodies knowing what and when to play, how to play it, and then stopping.
Right.
He never goes into excessive solos. I'm sure you've heard his first solo album, Change No Change.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think there is where he hits stride personally. But if you listen in the framework of the Cars, you know, he was very good at being part of a dictatorship, frankly.
Right.
You know, it was the Rick Ocasek show, no question about it. And Elliot Easton, as gifted in a guitarist as he is, he knew that this band was driven by Rick Ocasek, so he would do what Ocasek wanted. And I think that's what made him so good at doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, go and listen to the first album from the Empty Hearts, which Elliot Easton is a part of. And he still is economical, but man, can he let it fly.
Yeah. Woo! And it's a totally different style, but I think there are some comparisons to be drawn to somebody when it comes to clean guitar work. And that's the one thing that Elliot Easton always impressed me with, is the fact that not only, as you said, he was very economical with what he played, but it was always very precise, in the same way, in that sort of jazz rock vein, that Skunk Baxter always just annoyed the shit out of me, because, I mean, not with the music. I love the music, but I just would listen to him play these incredible, beautiful, clean guitar solos and think, human fingers shouldn't be able to pull that shit off.
Well, here's the thing, though. You know, there's those who play the self-indulgent kind of solos.
Yeah.
And then there are those who have the kind of firepower and skill that, like you just said, you know, human fingers should not be able to do that.
Yeah.
But because they're doing it in a tasteful manner, why not?
Right. There you go.
Embrace them that much.
I'm glad I asked you the question. Rob Ross and John Grayson, it's called Radio City, and we do this every week here on PopDose.com. We're going to turn our attention to what's going on in politics, because the shit show continues. And I don't think at this point there's any other way to describe it. We've seen a special prosecutor who has been assigned now, Rob Mueller, who was the FBI director before now former FBI director James Comey was brought in and then fired. And I mean, the whole thing is such an absolute mess, and it's hard to overstate the importance of the fact that we're talking about just now turning the page on the fourth month of this presidency.
I don't think it's going to last much longer. And don't forget, you and I talked about this on our last show, that how long do we think realistically this can continue?
Yeah.
And the answer is becoming clearer that it can't last much longer. I mean, we are in a full-fledged constitutional crisis. You know, Trump has stated to the Russians that he fired Comey because he was, quote, a nut job, and that this would ease the pressure of Russia off of him.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's a big, big no-no. The fact that Trump shared Israel's secrets with Russia. First of all, don't drag Israel into your fuck-up.
Right.
But the fact that you've shared military secrets. You remember a couple named Ethel and Julius Rosenberg?
I do. Yeah, it seems to me they were executed for treason.
Passing atomic secrets to the Russians.
Right.
Well, well, well. Now, let me think for a second. What did I just say about 2 minutes ago? Sharing military secrets with the Russians. My goodness. President Donald Trump has, in fact, committed treason.
Right.
Now, never mind the fact that his entire cabinet has committed various forms of treason. The president himself has done this, and there's no way around it. Now, how long they're going to take before they actually commit to an action, to getting the articles of impeachment in place and processed, it's now just a waiting game because it cannot sustain. It cannot. If it does, then there has got to be, I dare say, and I'm saying this with not a sense of humor, but actually with fear and a lot of disgust, there has to be some kind of uprising against this current government as a whole, because if they're not going to remove the sitting president that is doing all of this damage, then things are far worse than we even imagine to be.
Right. And again, you look at the acceleration of this over time, and it hasn't been that much time, which is kind of the point. It took a year for Republicans to start peeling off with Nixon. It took a week for Republicans to start peeling off with Donald Trump. Now, it's still not a big number, but you figure if any of them are ready to abandon him at this point, then what's it going to take? Probably not much more of a shove for that trickle to become a deluge.
I mean, for God's sakes, now we've got Trump talking so much about, you know, radical Islamic extremists, and then going to Saudi Arabia and making nicey nice with the country that housed and aided and abetted the 9/11 bombers.
Right.
And, you know, they're one of the biggest oppressors of human rights on every scale, certainly of women.
Right.
Oh. And now this multi-million dollar arms deal.
Not only that, but look at it this way. I mean, he made such a big deal on the campaign trail of, look at me, I'm big, tough, virile Donald Trump, and I'll say radical Islamic terrorism where Barack Obama won't even use the words. And what does he do? He goes to Saudi Arabia, makes a piece of shit speech wherein he does not say radical what? Islamic terrorism. Yeah, big tough guy until somebody else is in the room. What a pussy.
And let's see what happens when he goes over to Israel and talks to Bibi. Because,
you know, yeah.
If I remember correctly, and this is where I can have some fun with it, isn't Trump's son-in-law an quote-unquote, I'm using the words in quotes, Orthodox Jew?
Yep.
And isn't his daughter, Ivanka, you know, the daughter that he wants to fuck, isn't she a convert and an Orthodox Jew now?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I have kind of a working knowledge of how the chosen people operate. being one myself.
Yep.
I'd strike that, being not only being a Jew, but being a Zionist, okay, which I am.
Yeah.
I would like to see Jared Kushner and his wife be kicked out. Have them, you know, converted to radical Islam because they do not belong in our club.
Right.
They're not allowed in our club anymore.
Although Ivanka did have the nose job even before she converted. So, well, you know, there's that.
Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of the prelude to that's the prerequisite. I guess that's the prerequisite for women to join, I suppose. But Jared, you hypocritical piece of shit.
Yeah.
You know, and now it's also he's one of the persons of interest in the Russian dealings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So he's in on this, too. Even though he never says anything and never apparently does much, he still managed to get himself wrapped up in this shit.
The fact is that this entire thing has been the most horrific dog and pony show that completely, for all the good vibes that you and I emit when we do this show and we like to have a laugh, even if it's at somebody else's expense, this isn't funny.
No.
And it's getting worse day by day because we're talking about an entire nation, and it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, unless you're Bernie Sanders, then fuck you. But, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah.
And fuck you too, Jill Stein. Donald Trump has put this country so much in so much peril right now that we are truly teetering precariously on the brink of I don't know what kind of disaster.
And that's the thing, is we just don't know.
Something, God forbid, is going to happen.
Yeah.
I can't be any more stringent than that. Something, God forbid, is going to happen, because he couldn't care less.
Right. And that's a scary position to be in. I mean, when the best outcome you could possibly hope for is to have Mike Pence in the presidency, it gives you, well, and what it really comes down to is, look, go back to the campaign trail. Go back to all of those stupid Bund meetings with people chanting lock her up and all of this shit. And what it was an 18-month long temper tantrum. It was a temper tantrum that left us where we are now. Great fucking idea.
I will say this much. Now that we've had time to digest also, you know, everything that went into it, unfortunately, and you and I have talked about this, but unfortunately, Hillary wasn't the right choice either.
Right.
But she was the better choice. I would say we would probably still be where we were under Obama, which wasn't fantastic by any stretch. It was a whole hell of a lot better than it was under Bush, granted. But, you know, Hillary wasn't the right choice because, let's face facts, at the end of the day, she and Bill have a trail of shit behind them that stinks so far that they could fertilize from New York to Kansas.
Right. Right. So where is somebody who's just normal? Where's a good guy? You know? And that's so,
I hate to say it because I know exactly where you're going, and I've asked that question. And the answer is they don't currently exist. Right now, it's just a bunch of criminal elements in both houses of government.
Yep.
You know, there are people you and I both like. And certain choices we would make for our hopeful, and I'm using the term very loosely, hopeful next certainly Democratic presidential candidate. Because, you know, right now, all of the good ones have either retired, died, or said outright, I don't want any part of this.
Right.
Or the most logical choices, you know. I could have thought of and listed a whole bunch of people for this past campaign that I would have liked to see, you know. Warner from Virginia was one I definitely wanted to see run. He wouldn't run. He would have been a fantastic choice, and I think he would have won handily. It would have been a perfect selection, too. You get that Southern, quote-unquote, Democrat. He could have picked a Northern running mate. Would have worked, guaranteed. He didn't want to run.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And by the way, lest you think this is all, again, partisan and, you know, Democrat versus Republican and all of that, and that we're always all, you know, completely on one side, there is one other thing that, again, takes us back to the news media, and in fact takes us back to Fox News, because Bob Beckel was apparently fired for making an insensitive remark to an African-American guest on The Five on Fox News. And you know what? Good. Bob Beckel's an asshole.
They're all assholes.
Yeah,
and it's not partisanship.
Yeah.
It's, you know what? It's not partisanship because
he's the liberal. I mean, he's the left-wing guy ostensibly on Fox News. But you know what? I don't care. He's still an asshole.
And you know what? If you look at it, hey, we started talking about it last week. MSNBC is moving in a much more right-wing direction.
Yep.
They're going to get rid of the one voice of reason that that channel has, Lawrence O'Donnell.
Yeah.
The only one whose show is worth a good goddamn. Meanwhile, you've got Rachel Maddow being the doyenne of everything. She's like the poster child for the precious petals.
Yep.
Seriously, she is. You know, and of course you've got the morning's horseshit on Morning Joe. You know, why don't we just watch Joe and Mika go at it already? Because it would probably just get it all out of the way, and we don't have to listen to their drivel.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And there's not much to watch for anywhere.
I mean, you want to talk about bipartisanship? Okay, fine. How about having a show again, much like the Showtime series, The Circus, and the no longer on the air Bloomberg, with all due respect? How about a show of bipartisanship with Mark Halpern and John Heilman? Because those two are the only two who know what the fuck they're talking about on a daily basis.
Right, and can go back and forth with each other in a way that makes sense and is intelligent. And, of course, that's never going to work on TV.
Especially on an all-news channel.
Exactly. So,
bottom line is, right now, we should all, Democrats, Republicans, the only people who don't count are Bernie Sanders, followers. And I'm not saying that to be funny. Those people just need to go the fuck away.
Yeah, well, they didn't vote anyway, so who cares?
Your false prophet with you.
Yeah. Well, like I said, they didn't vote anyway, so who cares? But one last thing, well, actually, a couple of last things to talk about, because we have the NHL playoffs continuing, and I know you and I are both imbued in this and have our respective, the teams that we're loyal to. And with me right now, I mean, it comes down to the Nashville Predators. It's been a very strange series between them and the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim, which they will forever be in my mind. And, you know, Nashville is now up 3-2. They're one win away from their first ever cup finals. And it looks like it's going to be a really fun remainder of this series in the West.
Well, I'll tell you something. First of all, I'm with you on that one. I'm totally supporting the Preds because they're the Tennessee team. They've played fantastic playoff hockey. I mean, just absolutely shocking and crisp, up-tempo and hard-hitting. I mean, they routed Chicago. They took a lot of lumps from St. Louis. And the one thing I was really stunned by was them letting the overtime get away from them against the Ducks the other night. But last night's win was a good comeback, very crisp. Now, the Pittsburgh-Ottawa series, that one's taken quite a turn because Ottawa blew it in the overtime the other night, and today they got drubbed 7-0. 7-0. My God. That is just an embarrassment of the highest order. So I had thought, frankly, that the pendulum shift was going to go to Ottawa because they were younger and hungrier and less hurt. Because no matter what, Pittsburgh's got a lot of players who are there. I give them full credit. Who are playing hurt and who are just playing brittle.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to go, but I definitely think, and I really am hoping, that tomorrow night Nashville wraps it up, wins it, and goes to the cup final. And I would love to see them hoist Lloyd Stanley's Cup in Nashville.
Yeah. Oh, boy, that would be a lot of fun. So we'll see what happens between now and then. And, of course, we'll have some analysis of it. But I'll tell you, I mean, Pekka Rinne, the guy, if I could have any goaltender playing right now in between the pipes in the playoffs, it would be Pekka Rinne. So he's certainly been living up to the advanced billing. One other thing, and we always like to end our little conversations every week with a little bit of a segment called In Our Heads, and that's just exactly what it is, whatever it is that's been bouncing around in between our ears so far this week. And Rob, I'm going to hand it over to you because I know you've got something for us.
I do. You know, it's a time of anniversaries, apparently. Musical anniversaries, and there has been so much hype and hoopla for the last several months about this being the 50th anniversary of the mythological Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles. And all I was thinking about was the most overhyped albums in history, because to me that one ranks at number one.
Wow.
That is an album that from the time I was a kid, I never liked. There are some songs on there that I do like. You know, there's a song on every album I like, you know, inevitably.
Sure.
But when people put so much hyperbole and all these almost nauseating tributes to an album that was mediocre at best, it's also the first album where the Beatles weren't particularly coherent as the Beatles. Revolver was the last place where they were still the Beatles.
Where they were a band, yeah, sure.
This was the Paul McCartney show. Let's start with that fact, first and foremost. Second of all, the sound isn't that great. Considering this was supposed to be groundbreaking production, it still doesn't sound that great to me. The only really outstanding things on this album are McCartney's bass playing on a couple of tracks, because if you really want to learn how to play bass, listen to him and try and follow. Good luck. Although, I will say this much, especially since I bought my Hofner violin bass, I can play Lucy in the Sky pretty much on point. Not an easy feat for anybody.
Yep.
I actually like Lucy in the Sky. I like Little Help from My Friends. The Punchline used to actually cover it, and cover it pretty well, I might add, with a great deal of pride. our drummer Chris used to sing it. He was the Billy Shears.
Yeah.
And it was really a nifty little song to do. I like Getting Better, and I also like Good Morning, Good Morning. The rest of the album I can definitely live without. I never, ever, ever, ever have to hear A Day in the Life again. I never have to hear Within You, Without You. Lovely Rita, I can take or leave. When I'm 64, The World of Cardi and Garp. That's all you need to say. Sergeant Pepper itself. And, you know, I used to like She's Leaving Home, but, you know, that just is so overdramatic and so over the top that it just, you know what? It's when pathos goes into bathos, and it's so trite. So good riddance to it. Plus, I'm really not a big fan of all that hippy-dippy shit, and I never have been. You know, if I like psychedelic, I like the good kind of psychedelic when it wasn't called as such. That's why I still love Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, because you didn't know what to call it at that point. Or, of course, the things that came out by The Pink Floyd. Notice, The Pink Floyd. Arnold Lane, Candy in a Currant Bun, See Emily Play, Lucifer Sam. You know, that to me is really good psychedelic. Sgt. Pepper wasn't it. And with all the shit that people always voice behind it, no, it is the most overhyped album in history, followed very closely behind by the other album that I still, after all these years, cannot figure out why everybody has such a big old hard-on for it, Exile on Main Street. That is not the best rock album anybody ever did.
Right.
That's a fucking boring album, and I don't know why people get so up and just shout to the rooftops that this is such a rockin' record. This is when they were probably in their most depraved junkie period.
Yeah, yeah, and anybody who's ever hung out with a junkie knows they don't have a hell of a lot to say.
No, and this is not them. You want rock and roll and Stones? Go fucking listen to December's Children and Everybody's or Aftermath.
Right.
Or listen, even though it doesn't rock as much, Between the Buttons still has its moments. Hell, even Beggar's Banquet has its moments. But this album, not by a long fucking shot. I'm sorry. It's once again one of those scenarios where somebody who's in the know says, I really like that album. So every other dickhead on the planet has to jump on the bandwagon. Case in point, Peter Buck once upon a time said in an early REM interview, I was really into the Velvet Underground and the Byrds. And everybody glommed on to be trendy and hip to the whole Velvet Underground thing. Bullshit. Now, Peter Buck may have been a fan of the Velvet Underground because the man has an encyclopedic knowledge of music, of rock music, and its history and its lineage and everything. So I will give him that credit. But everybody else who followed in their wake, no, 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 no. And by the way, one of the most overhyped albums in history is Automatic for the People. That is an album that made me fucking hate REM and turn on them with a venom that I didn't think I could ever spew towards them. Because don't forget, as you and the whole world knows, this was a band that I loved from Jump Street. You
right.
know?
Oh, sure.
That was it. But that fucking record, they had already gone beyond turning into U2. They were so precious at this point, they became insufferable.
Yeah, see, and that's, I'm glad you said U2 because that's mine. That's my addition into this conversation. In addition to saying that, by the way, on She's Leaving Home, you are spot on accurate. I heard Sgt. Pepper on an 8-track in my mom's car from the time that I could remember. So yeah, I've heard every song on that album 100 times. And that's the one that, to me, epitomizes what John Lennon used to deride Paul McCartney's stuff with by calling it Paul's granny shit. I just stop, you know?
These fucking kitchen sink soap operas, you know?
Right, right. So I just never really had any great affinity for that and the harp in it and all of that. And it's like, yeah, okay, I know where you're going. It's just not being done very well. But when it comes to U2, the Joshua Tree, okay, enough. Oh, yeah. Just enough. They lost me after Unforgettable Fire.
You know, it's funny. I started to hate them when War came out because I don't know if you remember the video for the live video from for Sunday Bloody Sunday when Bonehead goes, this is not a rebel song. This is Sunday Bloody Sunday. And I sit there going, but that's what you fucking need.
Right.
You need rebels. Well, yep. You also have to take it in context. My mind was not quite right back then. I was unfortunately a very misguided supporter of the IRA and the struggle. I have since very much changed my opinions. But the point being, that was what was needed at the time.
Yeah.
And this fucking lunkhead comes out on stage and, you know, so I, and plus everybody I knew of that I went to high school with, for those who didn't listen to me and join me, you know, with this wonderful band REM, they all, you know, laid down and spread their legs for you too. And they all jumped on the War bandwagon. And man, I fucking hated that record.
Yeah.
It's a great sounding record, but I hated that record. And Unforgettable Fire, I hated Pride in the Name of Love. And I hated, there was one song on there that I actually really, really liked. Wire.
Yep.
It's a great song. If you two could have stayed the course in that direction, oh, it could have been glorious. But then fucking Within You, With or Without You comes out, and I still haven't found what I'm looking for. And then everybody's got the long hair, and they're all being really, really ultra. It was the first seeds of political correctness of the 80s.
Yeah.
And that fucking album just was everywhere, and they were on Time magazine. And all I could think of was, please, please, I beg you, go the fuck away. So you could not be more accurate.
Right. Oh, yeah. God. The Joshua Tree comes out and it just ruined it. Well, and the other thing is, take the edge and turn off all of the stomp boxes and all of the electronic shit that he layers on top of his guitar work and have him play guitar and see what happens. Cause I think I have a sneaking suspicion that what's going to happen is about the worst guitar player you've ever heard in your life.
Or at least a lot more minimal than what he makes it sound like.
Right.
I mean, I saw U2. You're going to love this if I never told you this. U2 was one of the two opening bands for the Teardrop Explodes.
Okay.
At the Ritz.
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. Not the Ritz. The Palladium. It was at the Palladium. The first band up actually was the band from Philadelphia called the A's. I don't know if you remember them. They had a great pop song called A Woman's Got the Power.
Okay.
But U2 was the next band on, and it was just as October was due out. October is an album I actually like quite a lot. And they were not bad live. They weren't a bad group live. It's just the whole, you separate the music, those abhorrent personas. Bono's pretentiousness is possibly, you know, the only one who is as bad and insufferable as Bono is Michael Stipe, and I think I may actually give that award over to Stipe rather than Bono now, mm-hmm. because you never really hear from the Bono Christ, you know. But I saw an interview with Stipe yesterday, and I just wanted to slap him. I'm sure he thinks he's just being funny, but it's not.
Yeah.
It makes your teeth hurt.
Right.
You know, shut the fuck up. Your band broke up. Stay out of the limelight. I don't want to hear from you. And any dimwit who goes around mourning the passing of REM 6 years, oh, I really wish they'd get back together again. And I know they always say they're not going to get back together, but I think they will. Grow the fuck up, will you?
Yeah.
And by the way, that brings me to bring up one final point, because this is pretty important. When a magazine has to pontificate on a less than mediocre band's rise and sharp fall, it's time for that magazine to pack it in. New York Magazine had the absolute audacity to do an article on the Strokes, a band who is as irrelevant as irrelevant can be.
Yeah.
This band never led anything. Yes, there was that whole, and I'm going to use the word buzz very lightly, buzz about New York rock bands at the end of the 90s and at the beginning of the aughts. And it was supposed to be the Strokes and a band called Ours, O-U-R-S. The Rapture, I think, was one of them. Interpol, who was probably the best out of all of them.
Yeah.
A young band that I saw that really got derided by everybody called the Star Spangles, who put out one album on Capitol and I think just broke up afterwards. I thought they actually were very, very good. The Strokes were about as nondescript as you could get. Nothing memorable about them. They had one song that got played and hyped because they were a bunch of pretty boys. Musically, they were an absolute flatline zilch.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, now, 19 years after their first record, Now you're writing an article about the last best band in rock and their fall from grace. Save it, kids. When I hear the best band or the greatest, you know, it's like when people used to talk about the Clash in the same vein.
Yeah.
The only band that matters. Oh, are you talking about the Jam? The Buzzcocks or the Undertones? Because the Clash sure as fuck ain't it.
Yep.
You know? So New York Magazine has got me thinking because I just got my renewal notice about whether or not I want to renew, because between having that kind of shit being written and the one guy who always writes these really anti-New York Mets articles, you know, you're not doing my city a service. Go back from whence you came, scumbag.
And we will leave it at that. Rob Ross, it is always a pleasure to talk with you every week here on Radio City. And, of course, we'll have a new one for you next time around as well. And anything we've got coming up that we should let everybody know about on Popdos?
Well, I think we should talk about the new Anton – new. Actually, it's been out for a while. It's just that I missed it. It slipped through my cracks through the incredible pile of CDs. The album from Anton Barbo, who's just – you want to talk about a gifted singer-songwriter and arbiter of all things neo-psychedelic. He is the American counterpart to Robin Hitchcock. How's that?
Very good. All right. We will look forward to that. And as we tell you every week, look around elsewhere on popdose.com. You're going to find plenty to entertain you in the musical vein, with television, with books, with what DX Ferris's great cartoons and everything else that goes on here. Just find something you like and hang on to it, and then find something you don't like and put something in the comments section about it. And we'll talk to you next week, Radio on Radio City.